From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After 3 years of war and mainly muted dissatisfaction, suddenly there came a tipping point.
Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk. We cannot continue on the present course.
John Murtha, the 17-term conservative Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania, declared the war in Iraq militarily unwinnable. And suddenly the debate was muted no more. Here was the reaction of Republican Congresswoman Jean Schmidt of Ohio.
A few minutes ago, I received a call from Colonel Danny Bupp, Ohio representative from the 88th District in the House of Representatives. He asked me to send Congress a message, stay the course. He also asked me to send Congressman Murtha a message that cowards cut and run, Marines never do. Danny and the rest of America.
All hell broke loose on the floor of the House and in the media.
Debate over the war heating up in Washington after calls for pullout by a former war supporter.
The decorated war hero who backed the Iraq invasion but now wants U.S. troops out in 6 months.
A veteran who voted for the war called for troop withdrawal within 6 months.
We'll talk to the man who pushed the country to a tipping point on the war.
The full-fledged national debate on Iraq had finally arrived, with the same players, but new dynamics, such as an emboldened press and a beleaguered White House. It was almost weird to witness, not least because, in the midst of debate about mischaracterized intelligence, the media themselves this week frequently mischaracterized Murtha's proposal as a call to bring the troops home now. That shorthand cut both ways politically, but ABC News political director Mark Halperin says, either way, oversimplification was inevitable.
There is kind of a simplification, which I think to some extent has worked to the White House's benefit in saying, as you suggest, some of the coverage suggests Congressman Murtha wants everybody out of there in 20 minutes and lock the door behind you. And, of course, one of the things Congressman Murtha has called for is a pretty sizable force to stay in the region for a while to deal with any emergencies. So there is complexity here. If you just go from the cable headlines, if you just go from the short snippets that some people get their news from, I think you would see oversimplification, and that's unfortunate, particularly since the congressman's goal, which the White House now says they celebrate and welcome, is a full debate.
On this program, we have frequently criticized the press corps, particularly the White House press corps, for being excessively deferential, even timid with respect to the president, especially after 9/11 and the lead up to war. That's changed pretty dramatically in the last couple of weeks. We've also observed the phenomenon where historically the press corps sometimes needs some sort of political cover to get very aggressive on a story, maybe action in Congress, what have you. Is that what's happened here, that the Murtha resolution has given the press permission to suddenly get confrontational?
The Murtha announcement is just one of a series of things, and the most recent, that I think has given the political press kind of a booster shot of recollection about what our role is in being aggressive at covering any government. I think when the Republicans in the Senate moved to demand increased reporting from the White House, that the press also felt more of a license to ask hard questions. It hasn't changed everything, and I think it's still a press corps searching for the right posture to have, as you said, post 9/11, during a time of war, when the White House calls accusations saying our opponents who question the war are perhaps giving aid and comfort to the enemy and demoralizing our troops. I think, unfortunately, a lot of reporters feel the sting of that. The White House has criticized the New York Times in a press release. A White House spokesperson criticized by name a reporter for NBC News in an interview. It's the White House's right to push back, as they say, against the press. And it's the press's responsibility to take criticism that's justified into account, but to not be cowed.
From the days of their first campaign, the Bush team has been very, very good at responding to attacks of all kinds, mainly by going on the attack themselves. This week, the White House went right back into that mode, chiefly with Vice President Cheney questioning the integrity and the patriotism of some war critics. But the echoes in the media seem different now. Have you noticed that? Has the media ecosystem adapted to the Bush administration?
This White House is very aggressive. They use the president, the vice president, all the spokespeople for the White House to be very aggressive. And in fact, in the view of some Republicans, even in the White House, too aggressive in going after Congressman Murtha. But I don't think that the press, as much as they are inclined to perhaps discount the White House in that mode, I don't think the press kept the White House from getting done what it wanted to get done, which was to try to recalibrate the argument, not about is the president doing a good job on Iraq, but should the Democrats be more trusted to deal with Iraq than the White House? And I think the White House got that point at least across.
Okay, Mark. Well, as always, thanks very much.
Okay, Bob. Thank you.
Mark Halperin is editor of The Note and political director of ABC News.
When it comes to intelligence failures in the lead-up to the Iraq War, Washington tosses around blame like a hot potato. But everyone agrees on the need to connect the dots better in the future. And so this month, intelligence officials launched the Open Source Center. It will be devoted to gathering all sorts of freely available information, from foreign media reports to websites to, and this is directly from the New York Times, slogans on T-shirts in countries of interest. By piecing these info tidbits together, the government figures it can learn a lot about the plans of potential adversaries without having to rely on spies and satellite images. But if we can do it, so can they. So the government tries to keep our bits under wraps, especially in freedom of information lawsuits, by invoking the mosaic theory, a trusty old tool often used in the Reagan years. According to the theory, individual bits of seemingly innocuous information, considered alongside other bits of information, can help paint a picture that's greater than the sum of its parts and expose important secrets to the enemy. But in the next issue of the Yale Law Journal, law student David Posen argues that the mosaic theory, by its very nature, is especially prone to abuse.
The mosaic theory, I think, has been kind of coded over time in national security law as this dangerous trope. It conjures up the idea of unknown adversaries exploiting information in unpredictable ways. And after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, that prospect seems especially frightening. Moreover, there's a kind of limitless character to the mosaic theory reasoning that while it's true that some information, though independently innocuous, can become more dangerous in the context of other information, that argument could be extended to apply to pretty much anything.
Can you think of a case where you think the mosaic theory was applied egregiously?
Well, I think perhaps the most egregious example was a case called North Jersey Media versus Ashcroft. In that case, the government moved to close deportation hearings to the public and the press. These deportation hearings have traditionally been open to both. The government defended this action on mosaic theory grounds, that information that might come out in these deportation hearings could threaten national security. What I think was particularly notable about North Jersey Media is that the government and then the court applied the mosaic theory to justify closing off all of these special interest deportation hearings rather than looking at the individual issues arising in a given person's hearing. And some language in the opinion is particularly interesting. In paraphrasing the government's arguments, the court says that it's unable to see the mosaic here. And this I found a kind of crazy statement, because why should the court be less able to see the mosaic of dangerous information potentially arising out of these hearings than any other body?
On the other hand, David, one could say that if there's anyone in a position to know which information might be particularly susceptible to a mosaic reading, it would be the government agencies whose job it is to generate and analyze this stuff. So shouldn't judges who don't necessarily have any expertise in national security matters be deferring to the experts?
I think courts should be deferring, but they shouldn't be abdicating their review role. This is why we have these courts in there at all. Because we want to strike a balance between national security needs and the public's right to access this information. I think that there's certainly a way in which courts can respect government arguments that are plausible and reasonable, but still call the government on it when an argument just isn't a realistic threat.
I guess that as tricky as it is for the government to argue, its case in favor of the mosaic theory, it may be more difficult to argue against the mosaic theory in a given case.
That's a big concern. The government is arguing that adversaries out there at large could use this information in some perhaps unknown way to threaten national security, and it's pretty much impossible to rebut that claim. You know, precisely because mosaic theory often cannot be proved, so to speak, the way a normal argument might be, it can become an attractive argument for agencies to gravitate to when they know their argument for withholding is tenuous. And because of that kind of potential for abuse, overbreath, and opportunism, I think courts need to be especially vigilant when they see a mosaic theory claim. Also, I think courts should realize that mosaic making is ubiquitous. Humans always make mosaics when they receive information. We always are looking for these inferences and these leaps between pieces of information to get something new out of them. So that being said, every case is at heart a mosaic case, and courts should realize this and not treat these cases differently than other FOIA cases just because the mosaic metaphor is invoked.
Is it true that in all the times that lawyers have tried to rebut the mosaic theory, only one case have they won?
In FOIA, that is the case. The government's track record is excellent at winning when it invokes the mosaic theory, although it should be said that the government's track record is excellent generally in national security litigation.
Can you tell me about the FOIA case in which the mosaic theory actually lost?
Sure. That was a recent case called Gerstein versus the Department of Justice. There, this reporter wanted summary statistics on the FBI's usage of Section 213 of the Patriot Act that allows the FBI to get search and seizure warrants without immediately notifying the warrant's target. And the government rebutted with a mosaic argument. It said that basically, if adversaries were to learn about the usage patterns of Section 213, then they could revise their counter efforts accordingly and better be able to get around the usage of these search and seizure warrants. There, the court actually said that this argument just doesn't hold up. And so it ordered the release of that information to the reporter. And I think that this case actually provides an interesting template for other courts to look at. The court did its own independent analysis to say that while we generally defer to agency opinion, this is just not a claim that's strong enough to win under FOIA.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me on.
David Posen is in his second year of studies at the Yale Law School. His article on the mosaic theory appears in the Yale Law Journal next month.
Coming up, big trouble at the LA Times and a new advertising campaign for a downmarket drink. Got beer?
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This is the season we give thanks for our families. And there is a media angle here, because though all newspapers have gone under the knife, papers that are mostly family-owned, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, have at least some confidence the budget cuts won't cripple them. But the Los Angeles Times lost its family when the Chandler sold the paper, along with the whole Times Mirror Company, in March of 2000 to the Tribune Company. And since then, that confidence has taken a dive. Its well-loved editor, John Carroll, quit this summer, largely because of bottom-line pressures. There have been waves of layoffs and some high-profile firings, most notably of editorial page editor Michael Kinsley and longtime liberal columnist Robert Scheer. But perhaps worse, the paper is in the throes of an identity crisis because its new owners live in Chicago and don't seem to get the California vibe, much less the paper's ambitions. Kevin Roderick worked for 2.5 decades at the Times as both reporter and editor. Now he blogs at LAObserved.com, where he closely tracks his former employers. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Brooke.
So the prestige of the LA Times seems to bounce around. One year it's perceived as a bit of a joke. Another year it's seen as a national treasure piling up the Pulitzer Prizes. So what do you make of the fluctuating reputation of the Times in recent times?
Well, the paper's reputation is a little bit of both. During the time that the Tribune has owned the paper, they've won at least a dozen Pulitzer Prizes. But at the same time, the circulation has dropped to the lowest level it has been at since 1968. And in that time, the Southern California region has grown tremendously. It's almost doubled in population. And the Times has not been able to capture that population and make them newspaper readers. The Times has put a lot of its resources and ambition into national coverage. It has a lot of national bureaus. It has foreign bureaus all over the world. It covers the Iraq War intensely. But here at home, the paper has been struggling to figure out just what is the right way to cover. It's really 200-300 cities sprawling across 6 counties, more diverse than anywhere in the country by far. And the Tribune Company, after it bought the paper, decided to get away from even pretending to be the local paper.
How did it get away from it? By pulling people out of the local bureaus or by
closing local editions? It closed local editions or scaled them back dramatically. That used to be that the Times had a staff in Orange County, which is the suburban area to the south of Los Angeles, that rivaled the size of the staff of the Orange County Register. Well, no more. That staff has been cut back dramatically. About 40% of the city of Los Angeles is in a region called the San Fernando Valley. The Times had a large staff there as well and has cut that back to just a fraction of what it was before. And all of these things end up giving the readers less and less of the local coverage that they can't get anywhere else.
What were the strengths and the weaknesses of the LA Times when it was still family-owned back before 2000?
Well, when it was family-owned, and even when it was family-owned, I should say that it was publicly owned. The stock was sold on the stock market, but the core ownership was still residing in the Chandler family. And at that time, it did have a very much of a Southern California rootedness, and there was not the pressure to deliver a high stock price for Wall Street analysts that there is today. That's really what's driving the cutbacks across the Tribune Company. Their papers still make plenty of money. There's a lot of industries that would love to make the double-digit return on investment that newspapers do. But the Tribune Company is being hit by analysts who say the industry is losing readership, it's losing advertising dollars. So show us how you're going to reshape yourself to get ready for the future. That's what's going on here. The Times right now is in the throes of a buyout and layoff process that's going to see apparently about 85 members of the editorial staff leaving before the end of November.
And I understand that'll bring the total of layoffs to about 200 in the last 4 years.
Yes, this is the second round this year, and there have been a number since the Tribune has taken over.
And there is a new editor. The much-beloved old editor left partly because of all the cuts he was being asked to make. The new editor, Dean Baquet, was a protege of the old editor, John Carroll, and he's much liked by his staff. But are his hands tied?
Well, you know, he did come in as sort of the savior in the staff's view. He was popular, and people saw in him a force who would stand up against the bean counters in Chicago. Well, that only lasted for a couple of months.
Baquet has been quoted in the Wall Street Journal recommending shorter articles, more entertainment coverage, and a gossip column in the paper.
If the Times could position itself as the authoritative observer of the entertainment industry, that would be all to the good. And local gossip column might be good as well, depending on the level of reporting integrity that they require. What Baquet has said is he would consider having a reported gossip column, more like the Reliable Sources column in the Washington Post than Page Six or the New York Post, I think.
I'm thinking that listeners may wonder, why are we focusing on the LA Times problems if those problems are so typical of the industry as a whole? But there are certain things that are particular to the Los Angeles Times that actually hold a lesson for the rest of the industry. How vital, for instance, local reporting really is.
The Times has tried to compete with its national image, and that was part of what was behind the hiring of Michael Kinsley to be the editorial page editor a year ago. He was seen as someone who would raise the profile of the Times in the national conversation. Well, the Times is out in Los Angeles. It really doesn't have the likelihood that it will ever be thought of as the national newspaper. And people these days have plenty of sources for national and even foreign news. They don't have very many sources for local news that's of any depth about the region where they live or the town where they live. And that's an area where the Los Angeles Times could shine and has shown before. And the new editor, Dean Baquet, has started to address that and said, well, you know, I agree that we've gotten too far away from being a paper that speaks with an authoritative Los Angeles voice. And he says he's going to try to fix that.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Kevin Roderick is a contributor to Los Angeles Magazine and a blogger at laobserved.com.
A news photo is sometimes worth a lot more than 1,000 words, especially in wartime. The image of a napalm-burned Vietnamese child fleeing in terror, for example, resonates decades later in ways that millions of words of reporting never quite did. So what if such war images were produced not by journalists on the ground, but by the military itself? Clearly, the 1972 photo of 9-year-old Kim Phuc never would have seen the light of day, nor the demoralizing evening news footage of American casualties. Yet in recent months, newspapers large and small have been running pictures shot in Iraq not by journalists, but by military personnel. The Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and many others have printed pictures distributed by the Pentagon via the Associated Press. Santiago Lyon is the director of photography for the AP, and he joins me now. Santiago, welcome to OTM.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
How many pictures do you move in a day, and how many of them are handouts from the military?
Well, we move typically globally about 600 to 1,000 pictures a day. From Iraq specifically, we probably move in the region of 20 to 30 pictures a day. And of those, it really varies according to the news. But some days there are no military handouts. Others there might be one or two. And during this recent offensive in western Iraq, there were days when we moved five or six.
Is there a special set of journalistic considerations attached to running a picture that originated with the military?
Absolutely. When I started in this job a year and a half ago, I was a little bit distressed to find that handout pictures, the only way one had of knowing that they were a handout picture was by the letters H-O at the end of the caption. And one of the first things I did with regards to that was to make sure that the body of the caption started with, in this image released by the U.S. military, in this case, so-and-so is happening, and then sign the picture off AP photo slash, and then the source of the picture written out in full, U.S. Army, U.S. Marines, U.S. Air Force, whatever it was. And I think that that certainly makes it very clear that we're not trying to incorporate military pictures, sort of hide them in our service. We're making very clear the source of those pictures.
Well, let's talk about captions. I think all photos come in with them, and they are the means to establish context, to frame and interpret what's in the image. Does the military's version of the caption ever go out on the wire?
It's rewritten entirely according to AP style. We apply the journalistic standards of the AP to all our captions. We need to know the location. We need to know the date the picture was made, if there's a difference between the date the picture was made as opposed to when it became available to us. We need to highlight that. There are times when if we have a question about the caption of a picture, we might well go back to the source and ask for clarification.
You know, in propaganda terms, I have to say that the photos that we have seen finding their way into major newspapers and small papers are pretty benign. I mean, they're not hearts and minds. They're not showing the heroic soldier winning freedom in the war against terror. In fact, they're really quite unremarkable. But what we do know is what these photos will never show. They'll never show anything that reflects badly on the military or on the war effort. We do know that photojournalists on the scene will make different choices, and that by using these photos, essentially the AP and the member newspapers surrender the opportunity for actual news. Or am I wrong?
Well, I think in an ideal world, we'd like to have our own people in place covering these operations, and we do make an effort to do that as much as possible. In this case, the feeling is that some imagery reflecting an ongoing military operation is better than no imagery. The same can be said for the White House. We much prefer to cover the activities of the President of the United States ourselves, but there are times when the White House limits our access to those things, and we have to rely on handout images. We're not happy with it, but we do it because we feel that the need to know at times outweighs some of the other concerns.
I guess what it comes down to is this. If a story came in to the Associated Press about the ongoing struggle against the insurgency in Western Iraq, and it was written by, you know, Staff Sergeant so-and-so, would the AP run it?
No. And to your point, I would say that one of the things I'm doing in light of this usage of military handout pictures is re-examining our position. And it's possible that in the future, as we do that, we will be even more judicious than we already are when it comes to using images of this nature.
All right. Well, Santiago, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Santiago Lyon is Director of Photography for the Associated Press. It is the weekend after Thanksgiving, which means turkey sandwiches, football games, and beer commercials. You know, talking lizards, fraternity hijinks, bikini-clad babes.
Nice.
Very nice. Do you think they're...
Oh, yeah. They're plastic. And they're spectacular.
Just in time for summer, it's the Coors Light Cooler Box. 18 16-ounce plastic bottles that stay...
The beer industry has poured millions into such ads for decades, while the liquor industry eschewed television for nearly 50 years under a voluntary ban, even now limiting itself to local TV and cable. Mostly, hard alcohol marketers concentrate their efforts at the point of sale in retail stores and bars, positioning their products as more sophisticated alternatives to beer. It seems at long last to be working. Market share is up for both spirits and wine, while beer has been taking a hit in recent years. Bob Lackey is Executive Vice President for Global Industry Development at Anheuser-Busch. He's trying to organize other brewers into a joint media campaign to fight back. Beer, he says, relies too much on one message and too much on the small screen. He joins me now. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, great to be here, Bob.
Let's start with, how nervous is your industry about this loss of market share?
Bob, this all has to be put in perspective. I think the media has made much more of a case of the death of beer, so to speak, than really I think is really the case. For example, if you think about the percentage of overall alcohol beverage consumption, it is about 60% for beer and about 28% for hard liquor, 14% for wine. I mean, that's hardly cause for panic. But I think if you look at the last couple years, beer is coming off its all-time peak. Then I think it kind of hit everybody all at once that we need to do something.
The industry is considering a multimedia campaign to put the best face on beer. Tell me what you're considering and how it's progressing.
The whole mission here is to elevate and enhance the image of beer. And the way we're going to do it is try to get all the brewers aligned and all the constituents that really have a stake in the beer industry, from the distributor on the ground to the retailer to the brewers, to kind of agree on message points and platforms that we could then take to everybody to share speeches, talking points, sell sheets to retailers. And as you go up the pyramid, giving them a chance to print templates out so they get coasters and table tents and menu cards and suggestions on how to pair beer with food. And as you go further up the pyramid, you know, think about actual media pieces, print ads that would maybe highlight some of the benefits. And at the ultimate top, at the capstone, perhaps occasional television advertising to spark some discussion and spark some publicity, quite frankly, that, wow, look at this contentious beer industry working together.
So we're talking about something like Got Beer? You know, beer, it's what's for dinner. Is that the kind of advertising we can expect?
We have studied case histories for other industries, the milk model, the cheese model, the cotton model, the beef model, everything out there, and we're trying to pick and learn from all of them. Just think about it. I mean, if you come out with an advertising platform for even a week around, let's say, Super Bowl or the Olympics, and it has a beer industry message, a united message from America's brewers that talks about some of the most basic things that I think a lot of brewers have lost sight of, you know, the social value of beer, the whole notion of romancing the product, that in itself will be worth 20-fold in terms of publicity.
Now, someone has said, it was either you or your competitor over at Miller Brewing, that one of the problems that beer is having with a younger audience is that it's deemed by an increasing number of people as less sophisticated than wine and distilled spirits. And fundamentally, you have to address the sophistication problem.
You know, you think about great taste, less filling. You think about I Love You, Man. You think about What's Up, The Lizards, all the incredible campaigns that have been done. It didn't just occur that in the last 12 months, all that's been a mistake. If anything, the beer industry can be criticized for taking their eye off of a demographic that was moving away. I mean, the demographic wanted variety. Was the beer industry giving it to them? Not even in packaging were we giving it to them.
But your opposite number at Miller said that we have marketed ourselves into this problem and we can market ourselves out of it. Was he not talking about the adolescent sensibilities that have informed beer advertising for so long?
I think that there have been some definitely questionable executions of which, you know, I've been the architect of some of them. I can admit it, but we've also been the architect
just to point out the igniting horse fart being right at the top of the list.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Yeah. But I think we've also had some pretty memorable work, too, with Clydesdales, and we've done some incredible stuff over the years with Louis the Lizard. And I will agree with you that the image has probably not touched on the themes that I wish we could touch on more often. You know, clever work that doesn't need to run the route of ribald or gross. But to say that that's the only issue and you can market your way out is absolutely short-sighted. Remember, you've conditioned your distributor to just deliver the product, stack it, and then let them to believe that if you win the Super Bowl, all is well with your television advertising. And that is not good. We need to get out and sell one-on-one because there's whole new generations of beer drinkers, potential beer drinkers, coming into the marketplace every year.
Bob, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Robert Lackey is the Executive Vice President of Global Industry Development for Anheuser-Busch.
Coming up, last year's Orange Revolution seen from the inside out, and a beat reporter's thankless Thanksgiving.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A year ago, amid optimism verging on euphoria, the Orange Revolution swept Ukraine. A rigged election was voided, and a heroic Democrat took power. In the year since, the ascension of Viktor Yushchenko has not yielded quite the utopia the street demonstrators envisioned. The government is riven with internal conflict. The press is again repressed, and due process remains overdue. Maybe this ambiguity was foreshadowed by the Orange Revolution itself, which was a bit less, or more, than met the eye. Far from being spontaneous, it was fomented with lots of help and $40 million American dollars from the outside. Last year, I spoke with Ivan Marovic, a founder of Otpor, the Serbian political student group that helped provide the Orange Revolutionaries with their template for success. I asked him to explain first how Otpor did it in Serbia, and then how he exported the creation of a whole brand of protest to other countries.
As a student activist and organizer, I was trying with my colleagues to find a way how to reach broader audience. Our inspiration came from multinational companies and things like Coca-Cola and or Levi's. What we needed was a simple message. What we needed was a simple logo so people could recognize it after 1 second. So that's why we picked a name Otpor, which means resistance, and also we picked a clenched fist. Our slogan was Gotovye, which means he's finished. And that was the most simple way to tell to the people that if they vote against Milosevic, he will be finished. It showed the good way of attracting one portion of the society which doesn't respond to classical political messages. And this is exactly what we were trying to pass to our friends and colleagues in Georgia and Ukraine, which is some sort of a package. But also the content of that package has to be carefully developed, because a package cannot do the job for itself.
Well, there are striking similarities between the Ukrainian disputed election and the one in Belgrade that marked the beginning of the end for Milosevic, but obviously the details were very different, and the sloganeering was different as well. What logo and slogan was embraced by your colleagues in Ukraine?
What they did is that they made the slogan Pora, which means it's high time, and their logo is actually the ticking clock, which symbolically means that the clock is ticking for Kuchma and for his regime and the oligarchs that are controlling Ukraine at the moment. And that is different from Otpor's clenched fist, which was more a result of 10 years of civil war and economic sanctions and totally different situation.
I want to ask you about the potential downside of the underlying reality that the populace is being manipulated by the pro-democracy forces in approximately the same way it had been for decades manipulated by the sitting government. Is there no chance for backlash when the people realize that they have been, toyed with?
This is not a manipulation. You can fool some people for some time, but they are in the street for 10 days now, and they don't seem fooled. They seem that they're fighting for what they want. And what they want to fight for is their right to vote.
Now, the United States has a long and often very sorry history of interfering in the affairs of sovereign governments. Is there no risk that you will be perceived as an agent of Washington wherever you consult?
I wouldn't think that branding or training that I and my colleagues did were the most important. We maybe helped them like maybe 1%, maybe foreign funding helped them 5%. But 95% or 99% was thanks to their effort and their readiness to fight for their cause. It's up to them to seek funding. The only thing that we need to know before we start trainings is whether the groups we are working with are fighting for democracy, human rights, and better society in their countries, and that they use nonviolent methods.
I think it's easy to dismiss branding as just the very essence of superficiality in the, you know, the commercial culture and so forth. But one thing we learn here is that brands are not nothing, that they are actually the convergence of recognition and meaning, no?
Yes. In the 20th century, branding was done by connecting a movement to the leader. So everybody remembers Lech Walesa or Nelson Mandela or Mahatma Gandhi. In Serbia, Georgia, and Ukraine, branding was done not connecting to leaders. Leaders could have been blackmailed or bribed or even maybe killed. You can't do that with brands or ideas.
So where next? Uzbekistan comes to mind, Zimbabwe. Is your phone ringing off the hook with pleas for help from around the world?
It does ring every now and then. And if they are asking for help, we're willing to help and to share our experience with them.
At the moment, you're in the United States creating a video game for the next generation of activists. Tell me about it.
This game, I think the working title is A Force More Powerful, is a game where a player will be able to organize a mass movement against dictatorship. It's going to be a violent game with prosecutions, with arrests, with kidnapping. The only person that will not be allowed to be violent is the player.
Well, Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ivan Marović is a founding member of the Serbian student movement Otpor. We spoke to him last year. The video game he mentioned is due to hit stores in January.
There are the five-star generals of newspaper journalism, big book writers and star columnists with postage stamp pictures. And then there are the infantrymen, grunts who pound the pavement on dreary stories for undistinguished papers, like Mark Stamey, formerly of the New York Post. Stamey is short and square-faced. He ran his own business for a while, salvage diving. Then he went to college, earning master's degrees in sociology and journalism. He was already 45 by the time he became a reporter, freelancing first for the New York Times before landing the job at the Post. He left the paper a few years ago because he was ill. But while he was on the job, he covered fires, injured horses, fires, evictions, homicides, and fires. Stamey was working the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade the day I spent with him. He pulled a sour face as Mickey Mouse, four stories high and six stories long, floated down Broadway.
I mean, that's it. The guy owns town here. Mickey Mouse took over 42nd Street. That's more than any gangster could ever do.
Stamey is cooling his heels at the parade, interviewing kids until something bigger happens. It does, and he's summoned back to the office a short walk away. He rarely writes a story by himself. In fact, he rarely writes a story. His job is to cover the story, go to the scene while another reporter is dispatched, say, to the press conference, and phone the facts, the quotes, and the color he gathers. He nurses a healthy resentment for his white-collar bosses back at the desk.
It's all right if I live in this world, but they don't want to even be brought, you know, aware of it. When I say you see, like, a dog licking human blood from the cracks of a sidewalk, I'm not inventing it. I mean, this is, we wait, well, sometimes we end up walking in gore and not knowing it.
Why do you do it?
I need the job. I think I would rather not do it. I mean, I need the money. I need the job. I need the...
You need this job.
I need
at the New
job.
York Post covering babies going out of windows.
No, I don't need to. Nobody wants it. No, I don't have any joy in that. None whatsoever. I've been told on occasion I'm too stupid to write my own stories. And that the only thing I'm good for is driving the car. So they got me kind of pigeonholed as a roughneck street guy. And I don't belong inside. Let's see what delights they have for us now.
Now at the Post, Stamey is sent on another story by city editor John Mancini.
This could be a little heartwarmer.
I can't wait.
Fred Nunez is 16 years old, but just barely, because he had a puffy jacket on, maybe not unlike yours. And somebody tried to, somebody did stab him for it, but they didn't get his jacket. Stabbed three times. He's in serious condition at Jamaica Hospital. Why don't you check, make sure he's still in the hospital. We're pretty sure he is, and then go see him. Maybe the family brought a turkey over and a nice new jacket for him or something.
Some bandages.
Yeah, so this could be...
Stamey climbs into his Jeep for the ride down to East New York. It's familiar territory to Stamey, the rundown districts on the city's fringes.
I spend a lot of time in a lot of these other, you know, outer boroughs. Yeah.
And are you saying there's, like, there's no glamour, there's no romance, there's no sense of living your own drama in doing this kind of work?
You mean like... you know, the camera swooping around while the theme song plays in the background, and here you are being grand?
Yeah.
No. No, it's all like emptying the trash cans and changing the bedpans. And no, there's no glamour in this. I can't imagine. I wouldn't be able to fantasize it being glamorous.
We arrive at the apartment house of Fred Nunez and park by a garbage pile. The building isn't locked, so we walk right in.
Yeah, the hospital.
Yeah, the hospital. That's what I thought. I think I'll go there instead. Yeah. Do you know Fred?
No.
Yeah? Does anybody else you know him? Maybe talk to somebody who knows him?
No.
the neighbors?
1D.
1D, downstairs? Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving.
He was like our cousin.
Yeah? Yeah, I heard he's a nice guy. I heard he just got up from his coat. Yeah, that's not good. We're here to help if we can.
After the interviews and a quick trip to the hospital, he phones in from an emergency room payphone to dump the quotes his editors will assemble into a story.
Yes, I do. I'm at the hospital now. We were just told that we cannot go talk to the family. But this kid's under heavy security because the perpetrators are still, apparently, they're on the loose. But I went over to his building where he lived, and I spoke to people who knew, everybody knew him. Everybody had the same thing to say about this kid, uniformly very positive. So one of the mothers in the neighborhood that knew him well, her name is Juliette, J-U-L-I-E-T-T-E, Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R, said, comma, quote, he got along with everybody, dash, all the kids like him, and I like him. It's such a tragedy for a coat. I'm afraid for my own son. He has a name brand coat, too, period, close quote. Good enough. All right, we got it then? Thank you, Andy. Is Mancini still there? Who is he, the one that tells me good night? Happy Thanksgiving, Andy. Bye-bye.
Having been good-nighted by his editors, he's free to go. So we take off. There's a diner off the highway on the way from Jamaica Hospital in Queens, not far from where Stamey used to live. They all know him there. Stamey says he finds it hard to relax. He doesn't have a close-knit family or a sheltering circle of friends. In fact, and he's pretty embarrassed by this, the only regular engagements he attends are Friday night Mensa meetings.
When you're covering your sixth fire in as many weeks, do you ever think to yourself, does the public really need to know about this fire? I mean...
Yeah, but then again, there's always that. Yesterday, I covered a fatal fire of an NYU student who fell asleep using aromatherapy candles. You know, if you don't know about that, you think, what a benign little thing. We'll be healthy, asleep all night, have a nice glowing light there. Wake up and the whole family's dead. Seen this a lot.
But it's the other stuff. It's the catalog of miseries. You know, does that serve a social function, a positive...
Yeah. It's not just voyeurism, and it's not just intrusion so much as it is there's a need, and we can tell people about it, and then they feel it. More times than not, people have come forward to help. Especially if it's someone who's been killed, you say, what can you do? He's dead. And say, well, do you want him to be forgotten? You know, just another toe tag.
You know, when I looked at your clips... Fire after murder after...
Train wreck after plane crash after defenestration after infanticide, parasite, homicide. I mean, come on. Whatever.
I thought, how can a person like that actually like their job? But you don't like your job.
I like it and I don't like it. The thing I like about my job is that it's infinitely challenging. It's a total 100% IQ test 100% of the time. Outwit all of New York City and get the story in the paper. What I hate is empathizing with the people whose children have been hurt. I mean, when people are just so stricken with grief that they can't talk and they can't cry, they make this sound, they call it the cri du chat, the cry of the cat. It's like a non-verbal, internalized, anguished wail that freezes in their vocal cords. And that stays with you. It, like, stains you, you know.
Back on the road, Stamey says the urban spectacles he serves up daily have earned him a twitch and many sleepless nights.
Yeah, I never want to be on that side of the story, but I live in constant fear that it's going to happen. I'm going to get shot. I think myself I'm going to get shot. I think anything can happen to anybody at any time, but we go out looking for it.
He fantasizes about moving to Florida or Tahiti, but that's not going to happen.
I wish there was a 12-step program for journalism, because it's very much like an addiction. It's an addiction because it pulls you in, it beguiles you, it hooks you, and then it starts turning you inside out. And the rush is gone, and all that's left is the hangover. The hangover and the tedium, and you're just doing it like a zombie because that's what you do every day, that's what you did every day, and it's not going to change.
Shortly after we interviewed Mark Stamey in October of 2000, he experienced seizures diagnosed at the time as post-traumatic stress disorder. It kept him out of work for 8 months. When he returned to work, we spoke to him again, and he described the symptoms.
Very tight goose flesh on my cheek or on my shoulder, and another area of my body starts sweating. I developed a tremendous twitch, a jerking in my head. It would be like I was being slapped on my left cheek. And that became impossible to control. It culminated in my coming to in the hospital in the intensive care unit. Absolutely no memory of how I got there. I apparently had a seizure while I was driving my car on the Triborough Bridge. I sideswiped another vehicle and hit the wall of the bridge.
And did your doctor say that this might be work-related?
Yes.
And how is it being back?
One thing, people treat me like I'm contagious. I've had people I was supposed to give notes to jump up and run across the newsroom to get away from me. I've had people like yelling across the newsroom about my condition. I hear you got a doctor's appointment today. It's common knowledge.
Doesn't anybody else in the newsroom have the same experience? Have they come up to you?
Yes. This week, two people from the newsroom came up to me and asked me if I could recommend a psychiatrist for them because they were starting to react the same way and it's starting to show on them. And they finally, at least some of them have the sense to ask.
Do you see yourself doing this for the next 5 years, 10 years?
God, what a horrible thought, huh? I mean, I can only play Indian Scout so long and then, you know, I got to like get off the horse and sit at my desk like a normal report if there is such a thing.
Soon after that interview, he did get off the horse, but he didn't become a normal reporter. It was later determined that Mark Stamey had epilepsy, possibly related to head injuries incurred in several incidents on the job, and he retired permanently from journalism.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org. Supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.